A federal law from 1948 puts the U.S. government and the state of Iowa in charge of policing the Meskwaki tribe on its settlement near Tama. This hour, why that may change. It's River to River from Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer. Caucus day, of course. Because of that, the Iowa legislature is not in session, but we still want to keep you abreast of what Iowa lawmakers are up to. IPR's Joyce Russell joins me this hour to discuss the Meskwaki judicial bill, also a bill seeking to raise the minimum wage to buy tobacco from 18 to 21, a bill that would ban Iowa minors under 18 from commercial tanning salons, and why the Iowa Lottery wants to acquire new touchscreen vending machines. That's all coming up. First, this news. It's River to River from Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer. Monday during the legislative session, we like to devote the hour to what's going on with our lawmakers and some of the issues that they're addressing at the state capitol. Joining me on Mondays to do that, Iowa Public Radio State House correspondent Joyce Russell. Hello, Joyce. Joyce, are you there?
Yes, yeah. I am. Hello, Ben.
I hear you. And we want to address a number of issues, Joyce, later in the hour. A bill seeking to raise the minimum wage to buy tobacco from currently 18 to 21. Also a bill that would ban Iowa minors from under 18 from commercial tanning salons. And then also changes that the Iowa Lottery wants to make to acquire some new touchscreen vending machines. That in our second half hour. Joyce, in our first half hour, this is very interesting. We have some history going back here to talk about the Meskwaki settlement. This is a settlement near Tama, and a federal law from 1948 puts the U.S. government and the state of Iowa in charge of policing the Meskwaki tribe on this settlement near Tama. And now there is possible change afoot. Can you introduce us to that before we talk to our guests and get into details?
Yeah, sure. The Iowa Senate has passed a bill. It's now in the Iowa House that would change things so that the Meskwaki settlement, as you said, would be able to have their own police and judicial system for certain crimes. Others would still have to be dealt with by the federal government. But this, it's the federal government has asked the state of Iowa, or rather the state of Iowa has asked the federal government to make this change. A while back, the House and the Senate passed a resolution to make this change. The federal government said that's not good enough. You have to pass a law. So when they're in the process of passing a law to grant more authority for law enforcement and prosecution to the Meskwakis.
Jay Finch is with you in the Des Moines studio. Jay is an Attorney General of the Sac and the Fox Tribe of the Mississippi in Iowa. Jay Finch, welcome to the program.
Welcome. Thank you to be here.
Uh-huh. And provide us with a little background, because you've worked in this area for 12 or so years. Give us a little bit of history, because we call this area where the Meskwakis live a settlement, not a reservation. That's one distinction I want to have you comment on, but also how the law works in this settlement area currently.
Sure. Well, anytime you're dealing with Native American tribes, obviously history is very important. With respect to the Meskwaki, in 1850, the Meskwaki were in Tama. They pooled their resources and purchased with their own money approximately 80 acres. In 1850, Native Americans weren't even considered U.S. citizens. They couldn't hold title to land, and so they went to the then governor at the time, requested that the governor hold the land into trust, and the governor agreed. And so up until about 1896, the land was held in trust for the tribe. In 1896, the federal government agreed that the federal government would hold the land into trust. And so unlike the vast majority of tribes throughout the United States, the Meskwaki were not placed on a reservation. They actually settled there, and hence, therefore, they call it a settlement. Mm-hmm. And that's why it's known as a settlement.
And how many Meskwaki live there?
There's approximately, I would say, maybe 1,700 enrolled members, and then give or take another couple thousand descendants total.
Mm-hmm. And so there is this cooperation, the U.S. government and the state of Iowa in charge of policing that. What does that mean in actual fact?
Well, what's happened over the years was a majority of the tribes throughout the United States simply share criminal jurisdiction with the federal government, much like, if you will, the state of Iowa shares criminal jurisdiction with the federal government. And in 1948, Congress, who has the authority to deal with the affairs of tribes, passed one little statute. It only pertained to the Meskwaki. And what it did was it gave concurrent jurisdiction, criminal jurisdiction, to the state of Iowa over the residents of the settlement. It didn't divest the tribe of its inherent sovereignty to pass its own laws. It just simply said, Iowa, you can also prosecute criminal cases. And so since 1948, there's kind of been this, if you will, triple prosecution potential. And so under existing federal law, the tribe only has jurisdiction over tribal members who commit offenses on the settlement or members of other federally recognized tribes. We don't have jurisdiction over non-natives. And so if you're a tribal member and you're living on the settlement and you commit a criminal offense, because of this 48 statute, you can get prosecuted in tribal court and in state court, and if it's serious enough, even in federal court. Whereas if you're a non-native and you commit a criminal offense on the settlement, you only get prosecuted by the state and sometimes the federal government.
And that is seen on its face as sort of discrimination to be – instead of this triple prosecution as a possibility for Meskwaki tribe members but not for others who are in that area.
Exactly. It places the Native American who commits an offense on their own land subject to the jurisdiction of another court, and so consequently, they would have to pay double fines, maybe do additional incarceration. Victims of crime wouldn't potentially have to testify twice, both in tribal court and in state court, and so the tribe's position is that is just basically fundamentally unfair.
Mm-hmm. Are there examples of cases where you see this triple prosecution throwing a wrench into things, making things needlessly complicated or discriminating against Meskwaki tribe members?
Not necessarily triple prosecution. We haven't seen that necessarily. But we have seen many cases where both, you know, a tribal member, a defendant, was charged both in state court and in tribal court and had to do, you know, different amounts of jail time, perhaps was placed on different periods of probation, subject to different terms and conditions. Whereas for a non-native, that would never happen.
Mm-hmm. And it has to do, correct me if I'm wrong, with the sovereignty of this 80 acres, this settlement, right? That this change would, or that this exists and this change is wanted.
Well, the tribe has always been a sovereign. Sovereign government, you know, long before there was even a state of Iowa, long before there ever was the United States, you know, the tribe was a sovereign. It's been recognized by the federal government, has the ability to pass its own laws and to regulate, you know, the affairs of its own members, and that's always been in existence since, you know, perpetuity. It wasn't until 1948 that a portion of that sovereignty. Because of Congress, that sovereignty was lost, and this kind of entered into a, you know, bit of a wrench in the tribe's ability to police its own affairs.
Mm-hmm. Jay Finch is with us, Attorney General of the Sac and Fox Tribe of Mississippi in Iowa. We're talking about the Tama settlement, the Meskwaki settlement there, and a bill that has passed, as Joyce Russell is with us, passed the Senate here that would call on Congress to give more judicial power to the Meskwaki tribe. And let's talk with two lawmakers we've invited as well, also in our Des Moines studio. Senator Steve Sodders, a Democrat from State Center and Chair of the Judiciary Committee. Senator Sodders, welcome back to the program.
Thanks for having me.
Also with us, Julian Garrett, Senator Julian Garrett, a Republican from Warren County. He's joining us by phone. Senator Garrett, welcome to you.
And thank you for having me. Pleasure to be back.
Steve Sodders, let me start with you. Tell us about this bill, which has now passed the Iowa Senate. It was, in fact, the first bill, wasn't it, to pass the Iowa Senate this session?
That's right. Yeah, we, in fact, moved the bill out of subcommittee the first week we were in session. And out of full committee the second week we were in session, or well, I guess we did both kind of the same week. And then, of course, the second week of session, it was the first bill on the floor of the Senate.
Mm-hmm. And what are the significant particulars of this bill?
Well, I think this just is something that, of course, the tribe is in my district that I represent. And we've been working on this for some time. Last year, I think people saw that we moved a joint resolution, which passed both the House and the Senate. But we felt that might be enough for the federal government to then repeal the law. It was after that that the Justice Department said, well, that's not quite enough. We need more. And so the tribe, the Iowa AG's office, the Justice Department, and even Senator Grassley's office all worked together on the language that we passed last week. And so this just, I think, sets a foot what the tribe has felt has been unfair, and it sets it right for them, and it is a piece of their history.
Mm-hmm. And what sort of cases would this affect?
Well, mostly your low-level cases, I think, as Jay mentioned. All your high crimes, so your murders and those type of things, that's typically always going to be done by the federal government. FBI usually gets called in. They do an investigation, maybe with help of the local jurisdiction, but they take the case through a federal court. And we've seen that even in the last couple of years. There were some high crimes on the settlement, and those were all taken through the federal courts. We're talking more low-level crimes, domestic assaults, thefts, those type of things, kind of your misdemeanor, more misdemeanor-type crimes. Those would be handled then by the tribal courts.
Mm-hmm.
And again, what people don't understand is if you look back in the past, 1948 to now, lots of things have changed. First of all, the tribe now has their own court system. They didn't in 1948. They have their own law enforcement agency who is trained by the Iowa Law Enforcement Academy. They're certified law enforcement officers of the state of Iowa. They have their own prosecutor. They have their own defense attorneys. They have probation. So they're really set up similar to our Iowa court system. And so they feel that they can now handle these cases fully.
Mm-hmm. And you're convinced of it, that they've grown into this role since this 1948 law was put into effect?
Absolutely. My background as a law enforcement officer, I actually have worked with some of their law enforcement officers on the settlement, and they're out doing their job. I've backed them up on other calls. I know they make arrests from drunk driving to theft to everything else.
Mm-hmm.
I'm very confident that they can handle these cases.
Senator, State Senator Steve Sonders with us, a Democrat from State Center and Chair of the Judiciary Committee. Julian Garrett, Senator Garrett, you're from Warren County, not Tama County, but you're opposed to this bill. Tell us why.
Well, I do have some concerns about it. What we will have if this bill passed, we'll have kind of a three-tiered system of justice on the settlement. Some crimes will be defined and the punishment will be defined at the federal level. Others will be at the state level. And then still others will be by the tribe on the settlement. So what is a crime at these low-level crimes and what the punishment will be will depend on your ethnicity. It'll depend on if you're an Indian or a non-Indian. It will depend on who's the perpetrator and who's the victim of the crime. The tribe will have jurisdiction over Indian perpetrators and Indian victims, or where there is no victim and the crime's the perpetrator is an Indian. Non-Indians who commit crimes against non-Indians will still be under state jurisdiction, and then non-Indians committing a crime against an Indian or an Indian against a non-Indian will be at the federal level. So it really complicates it even more than it is. Right now we have a kind of a dual system for these low-level crimes.
Mm-hmm.
Now we will have a three-tiered system, and as I say, the crime and the punishment's going to depend on your ethnicity. And I don't know of any other area in the law where we do that. Most people ordinarily would say whether you're committing a crime and what the punishment should be shouldn't depend on your ethnicity. It ought to be the same for everybody.
Let me get Jay Finch to comment on that. Attorney General of the Sac and Fox Tribe of the Mississippi in Iowa. Is that true under this change? Would it depend on your ethnicity, who you saw, and possibly your punishment?
Well, first of all, under federal law now, whether 1948 is repealed or not, we have a three-tier system. And in fact, there are other states in the United States who have a lot more tribes than Iowa. The Meskwaki are the only necessarily tribe here, and so this only pertains to the Meskwaki. But we have a three-tier system now where tribal laws apply to a tribal member, state laws apply to a tribal member, as well as federal laws. And so repealing 1948 simply makes it easier and fair.
So you're saying it doesn't complicate. You disagree with Senator Garrett.
It not only makes it uncomplicated, but any time that you're dealing with prosecutions of crime in Indian country, the first question you have to ask under federal law is the defendant a Native American or not? Because if they're not a Native American, then the tribe doesn't have jurisdiction over those kinds of folks.
Senator Garrett, how do you respond to Jay Finch there?
Well, he didn't really disagree with me. The current system, basically the state law applies. Iowa law applies in criminal matters. And the basic change will be under this bill that crimes committed by non-Indians against Indians or Indians against non-Indians will be handled at the federal level under federal law, whereas now they're all handled under state law. State law determines whether you've committed a crime or not and what the punishment will be. And we're going to change that, as I said. We're going to have a three-tiered system, sets of laws and three sets of punishments depending on your ethnicity.
Okay, let's have State Senator Steve Sauters address your concerns.
Well, there's a couple of things. First of all, if you follow that line of reasoning, theoretically, then we have at least 99 counties all have their own ordinances and laws, and every city has its own ordinance and law. In each of those, the punishment for certain crimes are different. Every single city. So that doesn't track. When you have each city that can make its own ordinances and laws, you know, Des Moines ordinance for parking is different than it is in State Center, Iowa. The punishment is different. The fine is different. And so that argument doesn't hold much water with me. To me, this is instead of double jeopardy in some cases, which we don't allow for anyone, the tribe is actually now under that rule. It's double jeopardy. So this, to me, simplifies the ability for those tribe to only be charged either by tribal court or state court, but not both.
Well, now, the analogy of city to city different ordinances, that does not hold up. City law has to be consistent with state law. Cities can't pass laws that contradict state laws. Whereas if we pass this bill, the tribe will be able to pass laws and set punishments that are in conflict or not consistent with state law. So that's not really an analogy. And as far as the double jeopardy is concerned, that won't change either. You could still have double jeopardy under the federal law and then under tribal law. So that isn't going to change that particular issue. And if the tribe doesn't want double jeopardy, they don't have to prosecute somebody that's been prosecuted in the state court or under the new system by the federal court. So this bill isn't going to fix that issue. You're still going to have the same issue. It'll be the federal government instead of the state. Will be the only difference.
Except for that's triple jeopardy and not double jeopardy. And there is the same, you know, if I have a speed in State Center, the fine does not have to be the same. They can set up their own. Speed on the tribal lands, Maybe they want a $25 fine instead of a $100 fine. Those things happen in the local jurisdictions now. I believe that's what the tribe is asking for.
Okay, we've got just a few minutes left. It gets into the minutiae here. We can tell that it's a sort of a complicated area of law. We're talking about changing a federal law from 1948 that puts the U.S. government and the state of Iowa in charge of policing the Meskwaki tribe on its settlement near Tama, giving the tribal courts there an elevated role in policing some minor offenses here. The Iowa Senate has now passed a bill that calls on Congress. This does involve the federal government to give some more judicial power to the Meskwaki tribe. Joyce Russell, over to you. You are legislative correspondent and here. Get in on this because we have a disagreement here as to whether this would be a good move.
Well, I don't know if we're going to settle the disagreement, but it certainly feels
not.
Like it's well greased. The resolution passed, as we said, passed both the House and Senate last time. That makes it look like this bill is probably going to pass both the House and Senate. So my question would be, is it a done deal then with the federal government, and how long might that take?
Oh, great question. And, yes, we've already talked to folks at the Justice Department. Senator Grassley's office is fully aware of this bill and has signed off on the bill. We believe that when and if it passes the House, the governor will sign it. And as soon as that happens, then it can go to Senator Grassley's office. And however their procedure is there at the U.S. Senate, I believe that this will get repealed.
Mm-hmm. I know this isn't the reason for this bill, but as you're discussing it, if the Meskwakis take over some of the police and prosecuting work from the state, will that save the state money in the end?
Well, it should, because, again, when the federal government pushed this onto the state, they never funded it. And so, so those crimes that could now be prosecuted and dealt with on the tribal lands will not go to the state or at least the county court, which is county taxpayer dollars.
And it certainly, as Jay mentioned, it certainly looks like the rank-and-file members of the tribe are behind this. You're aware that when this was passed in the Senate, a cheer went up, and these were Meskwakis who were there in support of the bill.
Yes, yeah, a lot of the tribal members were there, the council was there, some of the elders were there, and in fact, we heard from one of the elders after passed the Senate, who was still alive, and remembers when this sort of, as a child, the tribal members and her parents talking about this law. So mm-hmm. She was ecstatic to be alive and hopefully see this repealed.
We don't have much time left, Steve Sodders, but in talking about this resolution, you mentioned the oppression that the Meskwaki tribe has faced. In 2016, tell us how oppression relates to this issue. And I'm sorry, I only have about 30 seconds, okay. 30 or 40 seconds for you.
Well, just real quick, when you talk to tribal members, they see this as just another thing that was done specifically against their tribe, where they had no say. By the federal government. And, you know, originally the federal government moved them out of Iowa, clear down to Oklahoma and other places, and they actually had to move back to buy this land, to get this land. So this is just one more piece that they feel that is their sovereignty. And so they're very happy about this. But, you know, working with Iowa, though, they've always said, hey, we've had a great relationship with Iowa, okay. Iowa legislators, the Iowa governors. So they're very happy with Iowa, but it's always kind of been the federal government.
We'll watch where this goes. Then State Senator Steve Sodders, thank you very much, as well as Senator Julian Garrett, thank you. And Jay Finch, Attorney General of the Sac and Fox Tribe of the Mississippi in Iowa. Thanks to all three of you. When we come back, Joyce Russell will be with us as well. We'll explore some other bills afoot at the Iowa Senate. Joyce will tell us about three bills coming up, and we'll discuss those with lawmakers. It's River to River from Iowa Public Radio News.
Support for IPR comes from Faith United Church of Christ, Iowa City, an open, affirming, just peace accessible to all congregation where all members share together in a ministry committed to economic justice in the world. More at faithucciowacity.org. Additional support comes from the Iowa Energy Center, helping build Iowa's economic development through workforce development, by partnering with Iowa community colleges and providing statewide training for a new workforce generation.
And we're back midstream in this edition of River to River from Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer. It's a legislative Monday, we like to say, because during the session, when our lawmakers are at the state capitol, I like to team up with Joyce Russell, who is our legislative correspondent there, and track the activity at our capitol in terms of making new laws and changing the ones we presently have. Joyce, and I think this half hour we want to delve into three issues here that there's some activity we see at the legislature, and you cover that so well for us week by week. Let's start off, if we could, with a bill that has to do with the purchase of tobacco products. So what's afoot there, Joyce?
Well, Senator Kornbrook, who's a leading anti-tobacco guy in the Iowa Senate, would like to raise the legal age for tobacco purchases to 21 from 18.
Mm-hmm. Okay. And we have Senator Herman Kornbrook with us, a Democrat from Ames. He's also chair of the Senate Education Committee and a representative for the Tobacco Use Prevention and Control Commission. Senator Kornbrook, welcome back to our program.
Well, good afternoon.
Tell us, why is this necessary? Iowa would be, in raising it to 21, would be an outlier among U.S. states, wouldn't it, raising it from 18 to 21?
Well, I would call it a leader.
Right.
Hawaii actually has raised their age to 21. Mm-hmm. They did that last year. A lot of cities and counties across the country, 115 by the most recent count I have raised the age to 21, including New York City, Kansas City, Columbia, Missouri, Evanston, Illinois, 87 different towns in Massachusetts alone. So this is a growing movement, and I think it's a very important step to take.
Mm-hmm. Do we see in the places you just named that it's effective in getting youth, to let them not be addicted to nicotine, for instance?
Well, I tell you, one of the earliest examples is from the city of Needham in Massachusetts. That's a suburb of Boston. And between 2005 and 2008, they gradually raised their sales age from 18 to 21. Well, what happened was it not only affects people in that age range, but also affects the access to tobacco of people in the high school age range. Over that time period, the smoking rate at Needham High School was cut in half.
Mm-hmm.
So there's clear evidence that this would have a very significant effect on teenage smoking, and that's very important. If we can get a young person to age 25 without their starting smoking, the chances are almost zero that they would ever start. So that's really an important goal, is to keep people out of that smoking addiction.
Senator Kornbrook, this is Joyce Russell. Tobacco lobby, a pretty strong opponent of this. Who else would you call a worthy opponent of your bill?
Well, I would hope that anybody who cares about the health and well-being of young people would actually be a supporter. I know that a lot of educators are supporting this. I remember all the way back in high school, the teachers that I talked with were opposed to smoking, counsel people away. The Institute of Medicine did a study a year or two ago about the potential effects of raising the age to 21, and the rate of smoking initiation, in other words, the rate at which young people start smoking, for the directly affected age, 18 to 20, it would be a 15% reduction. But for the kids in high school, the 15 to 17, who get cigarettes from their older brothers and sisters or friends, they're projecting a 25% reduction in the initiation rates. So the benefits here are really significant.
Has a similar bill ever passed the Senate, Senator?
I don't believe so.
Uh-huh.
Like I say, this is a growing movement across the country. The evidence is building that this is an effective way to combat tobacco use. It is one of the priorities of the Tobacco Commission, along with closing the casino loophole and a couple of other things. But this is something that would be really effective at keeping young people out of the habit.
What about that casino loophole? Any prospects for that?
Don't know. It's early in the session yet. I know that there are a lot of folks who feel that was that was part of the legislative sausage making when we passed the Smoke-Free Air Act back in 2008. But that act has been so wildly successful and has not cost any significant business at restaurants or bars. I think it's time to address the casino loophole as well.
I'm wondering, Senator Kornbach, if aside from tobacco, the latest rage among young smokers are these e-cigarettes. You talk, you hear them talk about vaping. Now, would this address that at all?
Yes. It would make age 20, anything that's age 18 now, it would make age 21.
Mm-hmm. Okay, so that's included in it as well. How do you counter the, if you haven't heard it, I'm sure you've probably heard it multiple times in addressing this issue, that the classic argument, if you're old enough to vote, why should you be denied the right to buy tobacco?
Well, we have different ages for different things, right? You get your driver's license at one age, you get to vote at another age. We prohibit alcohol sales under 21, and for largely the same reason. A lot of young people, you know, they don't have the maturity of judgment, and when they make that—
They have the maturity of judgment to choose a president, though, is what we're saying.
Well, I think in a lot of ways they do. There's less possibility to do harm to themselves.
Okay.
I mean, age 21, it's age 21 for alcohol. It should be age 21 for cigarettes as well.
Okay. What's your projection here of how you will fare during this session for getting this through?
Well, we're going to try to move it forward. You know, often efforts, new initiatives take a couple of years to catch on. But we want to get publicity. We want to get people aware of this, the likely benefits. I think that when we do that, we'll find a fair amount of support. The Centers for Disease Control, the CDC, did a study. They did a survey. 75% of adults favor raising the age to 21. That includes 70% of adult smokers. So the people who are adult smokers, who you would think would be less likely to support, and they're a little bit less, but they know how they got addicted. Okay, most smokers I know would love to be able to quit, and most smokers, they know how they got addicted and they know when it happened. So I think that the support for this, if we can get people to pay attention to the issue, I think you'll find the support is quite significant.
So if there was enough support to support this, make this a law, Iowa would be the first state in the continental U.S. to do this, to raise it to 21, wouldn't it? Hawaii, the only other state.
Well, New Jersey, I believe just this last month, the legislature in New Jersey passed an age 21 bill. Governor Christie vetoed it. I suspect it had something to do with his presidential ambitions. But there are four other states that have raised the age to age 19. That includes Alabama, Alaska, Utah, and New Jersey. Alabama, Alaska, and Utah, not exactly hotbeds of liberalism, but they've already gone to 19.
All right. Thank you very much. We'll watch this. Joyce Russell will be reporting on it, of course. Senator Herman Kornbach, a Democrat from Ames, talking about a bill which he filed to introduce, seeking to raise the minimum age to purchase tobacco products from 18 to 21 years old. Senator Kornbach, always nice to talk with you.
Thank you for your time.
Joyce, we've got a couple other bills we want to talk about here. Another one here that has been linked to cancer. In a different way, tanning beds, a bill that would ban Iowa minors under the age of 18 from these tanning salons.
That's right. Steve Satters was in here just a few minutes ago, and this has become a perennial, this restricting young people from the tanning booth. And he said he offered this 4 years ago. So the effort to do this has been around for a while. It's interesting that we're talking about the tobacco bill and the tanning bill because the American Cancer Society would like to see both of those go into effect.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. And joining us to talk about this bill, Timmy Brown Powers is a representative in the Iowa House, a Democrat from Waterloo. Representative Brown Powers, welcome to our program.
Thank you for having me.
Why is the time ripe for this, to ban minors under 18 from these commercial tanning salons?
Well, I think the timing has been right for a lot of years. I think that hopefully we have done our due diligence and educated our colleagues with the risk of melanoma. And we know that Iowa is as higher, slightly higher, with melanoma cases in our young folks, and that number has continuously gone up throughout the years. And so it is our hope to pass a clean bill to restrict anyone 18 and under from using the tanning bed.
Mm-hmm. Is that rise that you mentioned definitely linked with the use of tanning beds?
Yeah. So what we know right now is that melanoma is the most prevalent cancer among young adults 25 to 29, and it's the second most prevalent cancer among our 15 to 29-year-olds. And that's primarily in our female population, not totally, but primarily in our female population. And we know that those numbers, our melanoma cases are going up every year, just so slightly, with the tanning bed.
Mm-hmm. And this is a personal issue for you, the reason you're supporting it. You have a background that addresses some of this,
right.
The fallout, right?
Right. Well, I work in Waterloo at Covenant Medical Center, and I run a cancer rehab program. So I firsthand get to work with some of these patients who are going through the scary diagnosis of cancer. And melanoma is extremely scary. And if not caught soon enough, it can, you know, the outcome can be very negative for those folks. And the other thing that we're seeing is we're working with Dr. Husha down in Iowa City, and he is the top melanoma surgeon in the area, and he has young folks that he's just carving away their skin and giving them a prognosis not real favorable for melanoma diagnosis. And so, you know, when you see it firsthand and when you work with these folks firsthand, you really understand the realism of this. And I'm a fair-skinned person, and I know I love to have a little color too, but, you know, I do the spraying tan. So I'm tan year-round, but I'm not damaging my body with the UVs.
Is there a misconception out there, Representative Brown Powers, that these tanning beds are safer than the sun? I don't know. I can't recall the science on it, but can you go to, depending on the tanning bed, a place that is safer than another?
So there is a misconception. I think people think that you can gradually get tanned, especially if you're going to go on a trip. You should go to the tanning bed first and kind of get that first burn out of the way. And
to protect yourself. Yeah, that's the conception,
yourself,
right? Yeah.
Right. Or if you've got, some different skin disorders, you should go there and it'll help those skin disorders. Now, the tanning bed in a tanning salon that is not a safe place to go to treat any medical condition, nor is it a good place to go to get your first burn before you go on a vacation. You know, what we should do is really encourage sunscreen. So we want folks to, you know, being used sunscreen when they go on that vacation to avoid a burn altogether would be ideal, but to avoid, you know, the skin getting exposed. Now, the UV in a tanning bed is much stronger than our sun. And when you're laying in those tanning beds, you've got those UV bulbs right below you and right above you in a coffin, just baking that skin. So we know that's – and unfortunately, you can go in there for, you know, as little as a few minutes to 20 minutes. And unfortunately, our young gals like to go in there for as long as they can to get as dark as they can because they think that it makes them look better.
Mm-hmm. Representative, this is Joyce Russell. I'm wondering what has kept this from passing out. You know, we looked at the list of organizations that are – lobbying against that, and the only one we could find was the Tanning Association. I think I understand they were the ones that spoke out against it in subcommittee.
Right.
On the other side, you've got cancer experts, the Cancer Society, health experts, and so on. So what's really – is it a personal liberty thing that's getting in the way, or that parents should have the right to give their kids permission to do that?
Unfortunately, that's exactly what it is. Yeah, we met subcommittee this week with Representative Forstall and Representative Fry, and the only person there that was not for this bill was the American Sun Tanning Association. And in the push for last year, if we go back to last year, we had that bill last year, and it died in committee because there were folks on committee, not subcommittee, but committee, human resources, that felt like they wanted to amend it to have a parent's choice for 16 and 17-year-olds. The problem is, I was listening to the tobacco debate earlier with that you guys did with Senator Cornwall, and I relate the tanning bed very closely to the smoking. And so we don't have a parent consent so you can smoke, and we don't have a parent consent so that you can drink. And I think that tanning bed, because of the mortality rate and the increase of melanoma for skin cancer, is hitting right up there. So I don't think we need a consent to have our young girls and boys go in and tan. One of the arguments is, you know, do we go for an amendment just to get it started? And I would rather, if we can just pass a nice, clean bill and give those parents the out. It's not their fault they have to say no to you. It's the representative and senator's fault they passed a law that you can't go tan.
Okay. I guess another bill we'll watch, Representative Timmy Brown Powers of a Democrat from Waterloo, talking about a bill that would ban Iowa minors under the 18 years of age from commercial tanning salons. Thank you very much, Representative Brown Powers.
Thank you.
And finally, Joyce, we want to tackle very quickly in these remaining minutes something that has to do with the Iowa lottery. They want to do what now?
Well, you've been able to buy lottery tickets in kiosks for some time. The as I understand it, the contract on those machines is about to end. And so the lottery folks want to renew that contract, as I understand it, with a touch screen version of the kiosk lottery site. And that reminds people of the controversy over the touch play machine several years ago.
Well,
that
sure
to
does.
A lot of people, yeah. To a lot of people, looked like slot machines, and they were everywhere. Every little
right.
Every little convenience store in the state.
Seemed like we were being inundated and told that you buy a gallon of milk and you need to gamble a little bit. Representative Quentin Stanerson is a Republican from Cedar Point. You're in favor of this bill, Representative Stanerson?
Yes, I am.
Tell us why this works for you.
Well, you know, I don't think it's really changing too much of what we have currently. It's just the lottery updating its fleet with the current technology. A lot of these, like was mentioned before, I think Joyce said, there's already these vending machines that have been in stores for better part of a decade here. And what we're running into now is that these machines are no longer being manufactured and they need to be replaced. And so everything's getting updated with technology. And, you know, now everything has these touch screens. And that's what they're looking to do. Wouldn't change what's in there, just updating technology. And yes, it's not touch play. Whenever you talk about touch screens, that old the touch plays come out. And, people start looking pretty hard when they saw.
So what is the difference? Touch screen, touch play. I mean, it's what is the difference? What is the lesson that you have learned or that taking away in introducing or allowing these new screens, Representative Stanerson, so that we can avoid, or you think you can avoid, the furor that erupted in 2006 over those touch play.
All right. These aren't you know, those touch plays then looked like slot machines, and you could actually have put money in and gamble and get your winnings right then and there. These touch play lottery machines, vending machines that they're putting in, are just machines that you would use. You would put your money in there to buy your scratch ticket, let's say. You would hit the symbol on there to purchase your ticket. They'd kick out your ticket, and you would go on your way instead of going up to the counter or using the current vending machines that there are now. And these machines do not – they would give you your change. If you put a five in, only one to buy a dollar worth of tickets, they'd give you your change, but in no way can you get winnings from them or anything like that.
And Representative Sanderson, it's pretty clear that this should I say it's pretty clear that this is not making it easier to buy lottery tickets? Or are you going to hear that argument, this is making it easier to gamble?
Well, I've had our subcommittee and our committee meeting, and that was not brought up there. I don't believe it is making it easier to gamble. Currently, there's about 260 locations in the state of Iowa, of the 2,400 retail locations around Iowa that have the scratch tickets, all your pull tabs are already sold in there. If anything, in talking to the lottery, there would be fewer machines because the price of this technology and the price of these machines is so much greater that they would really be looking at their marketplaces and making sure that these were profitable enough to put them in there. So in some locations, you might even just lose the availability of these vending machines.
Mm-hmm. Are we going to be treated to some demonstrations? Is somebody going to bring a old touch play machine in and then the new thing so you can demonstrate how they're different?
I've had offers to go take a tour and go and see these machines for myself, and I'll probably do that. I'd probably be wise to go and check those out so then when I get these phone calls from folks, I can assure them that they are not the touch play machines.
Representative Quentin Sanderson, thank you very much. Republican from Cedar Point will watch that as well and move for great. New self-service kiosks for lottery tickets, Iowa
That's
lottery.
Great. And make sure everybody gets out in caucuses today.
That is the message we also want to leave. Joyce Russell and I will be here this evening pulling also a late shift, as will a lot of the Iowa Public Radio crew, to bring you results, returns from the 2016 presidential caucus. Join us tonight. Also, political analyst Jim McCormick of Iowa State University, live reports from Joyce and others here at Iowa Public Radio, in the field, party leaders, our coverage from NPR and IPR beginning at 7 this evening. Joyce, you're as excited as I am, I bet.
It's always fun. I like it.
All right. We'll talk later this evening. River to River is produced by Claire Roth, Emily Woodbury, and Lindsay Moon. Our executive producer is Catherine Perkins. River to River is a production of Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer. Thanks for joining us on this caucus day.